Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, December 24th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. A few scattered rural power outages remain from last Wednesday's windstorm. As of this afternoon, in Clearwater Power's service area in eastern Latah County and Clearwater County, Washington Governor Bob Ferguson announces proposed state budget for fiscal year 2027. And University of Idaho grad students point out TA pay is not enough to pay for University of Idaho's new housing initiative. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Clearwater Power Company, which supplies power to rural areas of north-central Idaho, showed on its outage map there are still 211 out of 12,235 customers without power as of dusk on Christmas Eve. The outages came as high winds Wednesday morning of last week pummeled the area, and again Thursday night, sending branches and trees crashing into power lines. The late afternoon map showed 21 of the Clearwater Power customers without power were east of Moscow in Latah County, and about 166 were in Clearwater County in the Orofino area. Avista reported they had restored power to all 429,000 of its customers in eastern Washington and northern Idaho by Monday. At the storm's peak Wednesday morning last week, Avista had 71,600 customers without power in the company's vast service area. Clearwater Power is an electrical co-op, and their power rates are cheaper than Avista's, but they don't have as many line crews to mobilize after weather events. The Lewiston Tribune reported there were 500 Clearwater Power customers without electricity as of Tuesday afternoon across its service area, which stretches into southeastern Washington. The company wrote in their Facebook post Tuesday, "With so many separate outages and significant infrastructure damage, 16 contracted and cooperative line crews have been added to restoration efforts, along with additional contracted vegetation management crews." At its peak last week, Clearwater Power had 10,000 customers without electricity. The company has more than 3,000 miles of power lines across their mostly rural service area. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson released his proposed supplemental budget Tuesday that includes $800 million in spending cuts, but would shift unspent funds and use $1 billion from the state's rainy day fund to begin reducing the state's predicted $2.3 billion deficit. The budget is called supplemental because it makes adjustments to the biennial budget the legislature approved earlier this year. The adjustments mostly cover the second year of the two-year budget, which ends June 30, 2027. Ferguson said during a press conference Tuesday the budget would be about $1.2 billion over previous budgets, which is a 1.5% increase, and would include $885 million in unavoidable cost pressures, as he put it. The governor said, "In this proposed supplemental budget, I am providing a roadmap to the legislature. This is, of course, the first step in a conversation about how to best balance our budget."
We started with a $1.6 billion shortfall in this supplemental budget. That shortfall due to declining revenue, caseload increases, and other mandatory costs. In addition, state agencies submitted about $2 billion in budget requests that they describe as critical needs. I went through those in detail with our budget team and funded $700 million of those requests. Won't go through them all, of course. Katie's available to provide it to you, but I'll give you a few examples of the kinds of programs we funded there. $18.5 million to fund health care for Washingtonians who became ineligible for Medicaid overnight when Donald Trump signed H.R. 1, the big bad betrayal of the bill. These are individuals who are very ill or disabled many of whom are at risk of losing their housing if they do not have health care coverage. We did $6.5 million in this proposed budget to protect our farms and agriculture from pests that destroy crops and impact our economy. We did $15 million for ongoing support for the University of Washington's Center for Behavioral Health and Learning to help those struggling with serious physical and behavioral health problems. As a result of those $700 million in essential services, that puts the problem that we need to solve with our budget shortfall at approximately $2.3 billion. Here's how we solved it. First, I propose ending two tax exemptions for large corporations that save approximately $89 million every year. One of those is a tax break for data centers. So I want to be clear about this. There's different tax breaks for data centers, so I want to be clear about this. Currently, when a data center replaces server equipment, that replacement is exempt from sales tax. I'm proposing to repeal that exemption, which saves about $63 million for fiscal year 2027. We are leaving in place the sales tax exemption for data center construction and the initial purchase of server equipment. So two different concepts there. The second tax break that I propose eliminating is a preferential B&O tax rate for prescription drug wholesalers. Currently, businesses that warehouse and resell prescription drugs pay less than one-third the B&O tax rate paid by other wholesalers. This primarily benefits a small group of large national distributors, not patients. We are proposing to repeal, of course, that tax break and saving approximately $26 million every year. Second, we're utilizing approximately $123 million in unspent money from funds across state government. Third, we made difficult decisions to make about $797 million in reductions to state agencies, including administrative reductions. We made significant reductions earlier this year in the last legislative session, so these are obviously not easy. We're asking a lot of agencies during a challenging time. So those were not easy to make, but those are in the budget. This also includes reducing recent expansions and increases to programs and delayed implementation of other programs. Fourth, I propose using approximately $1 billion from the Rainy Day Fund. Fifth, the remaining $300 million is a combination of temporarily changing how we allocate capital gains tax funds, DOR request legislation on insurance premiums tax, and shifting other non-tax resources.
That was Washington Governor Bob Ferguson. Ferguson says much of the blame for the state's budget crisis lays with the White House.
Part of the reason we're facing a shortfall is we're dealing with devastating impacts from cynical and chaotic federal policy from the Trump administration. So, for example, as one of the country's most trade-dependent states, these tariffs hit Washington State especially hard. Earlier this year, our state finance office did a detailed analysis of the impacts of these tariffs. They concluded that the tariffs could result in significantly higher costs for Washington families, the loss of tens of thousands of jobs in our state, and billions of dollars in lost revenue. The tariff implementation has, without any question, been chaotic, and I know from personal conversations with many Washingtonians and business owners that these tariffs are impacting them in significant ways. In addition to tariffs, H.R. 1, Big Bad Betrayal Bill, directly impacts this budget. Let me be specific. In this biennium alone, that bill will cost our state at least $165 million. I want to be clear, it's hard to quantify each impact, as you might imagine, but that includes, to give you some sense of that, about $16 million to implement new work requirements for SNAP recipients. That's required by H.R. 1. Another $20 million will go towards IT costs for implementing requirements of H.R. 1. Starting in October of 2026, Washington will be required to increase our fund match for SNAP's administrative costs from 50% to 75%. We project that will cost about $45.7 million. The Trump administration also kicked approximately 30,000 refugees, asylees, and other immigrants with lawful status off of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. State law requires that we provide state-level food benefits to anyone who would qualify for SNAP, but do not receive benefits based solely on their lawful immigration status. Consequently, this budget provides $49 million for these food benefits that are extremely important. When the Trump administration unlawfully shut down SNAP benefits earlier this year, we spent about $2 million to provide additional assistance to mitigate those harms across our state. We're also responding to draconian cuts by the Trump administration to Planned Parenthood. Specifically, my budget proposes backfilling the federal Medicaid funding for Planned Parenthood cut in H.R. 1. That's an estimated $15 million. And just a note here, in any budget, there are thousands of items. We recently discovered one item was missing that is very important. That's restoring the $8.5 million funding cut to the Abortion Access Fund. We will correct that in January when we communicate corrections to the legislature. As you know, it's part of the process. There's always corrections. That one will be added into the January corrections.
That's Washington Governor Bob Ferguson. Washington is one of a very few states without an income tax. At his news briefing Tuesday, Ferguson said he supports a proposal for an income tax on millionaires.
The millionaires tax, which I hope will be adopted in this session, will not and cannot solve our short-term budget challenges. Two different conversations. As a result, my proposed budget does not rely on it, does not propose it. According to the Department of Revenue, the proceeds from a millionaire's tax won't come in until approximately 2029, and that's just to be clear, even if adopted in this upcoming legislative session. As you all know, Washington has one of the most regressive tax systems in the entire country. We rank 50th, next to last, among the 50 states and the District of Columbia in the fairness and equality of our tax system. I know everybody here in this room understands this, but I want to be really clear to the people of the state of Washington. This means that those who make the least amount of money pay much larger shares of their income than those with the most resources. Specifically, Washington families whose income is in the bottom 20% pay a whopping 13.8% of their total income in taxes, while those whose income is in the top 1% pay only 4.1% of their income. That is untenable. We are facing an affordability crisis. It is time to change our state's outdated, upside-down tax system to serve the needs of Washingtonians today. To make our tax system more fair, millionaires should contribute more towards our shared prosperity. To be clear, by millionaires, I mean people who make more than $1 million of income in a single year. In other words, it is not individuals whose net worth reaches that amount based on, for example, the value of their home. It's $1 million of income in a single year. In recent years, the inequities of our state's current tax structure have been exacerbated by increasing income inequality, which is made even worse by President Trump's massive tax cuts for the wealthy, an unprecedented upward transfer of wealth that makes the rich even wealthier, while hardworking people are overburdened. To rebalance this unfair system, I support a millionaire's tax. Let's make this historic change in this upcoming legislative session. The specifics will vary depending on the details of the proposal that goes forward, but less than one-half of 1% of Washingtonians will pay the millionaire's tax, and it will raise at least $3 billion every single year. I understand that individuals who make less than $1 million each year might be skeptical that an income tax would never be extended to them. That's why I support codifying the $1 million threshold with appropriate adjustments for inflation into state law. In other words, the millionaire's tax would be paid on income over $1 million in its first year, and while the amount of annual income that triggers millionaire's tax will rise due to inflation, that amount will never impact 99% of Washingtonians. A constitutional amendment is one way to provide this assurance. I want to be clear that I will not support income tax for people who make less than $1 million in a year.
That was Washington Governor Bob Ferguson unveiling his proposed budget for next year's legislative session at a press conference on Tuesday. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by listeners like you and by Giant Palouse Earthworm, providing DIY music booking in Moscow and Pullman, focusing on extreme metal, punk, hardcore, and the avant-garde. Giant Palouse Earthworm is available on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors for helping make this programming possible.
A southern Idaho man pled guilty Monday to killing four people in a murder spree that occurred July 8th in Cassia and Minidoka counties. 56-year-old Benjamin Roy Naylor of Burley pled guilty to two counts of murder in Cassia County and two counts of murder in Minidoka County. On July 8th at about 3:30 p.m., police responded to a home in Rupert for, quote, an unattended death that occurred under suspicious circumstances. A probable cause affidavit issued after police arrested Naylor a week later said police found a woman dead in a bedroom with at least one gunshot wound to the head. Police reviewed the doorbell camera footage and saw a man with, quote, a darker mustache and light beard, wearing a black full-brimmed hat, camouflage print jacket, a dark-colored t-shirt with a multicolored logo, black shorts, white socks, and light-colored tennis shoes, come to the door and knock at 1:34 p.m. The affidavit says another video from that location in Rupert shows a man wearing a yellow glove on his left hand, and his right hand was holding a firearm tucked under his jacket on the left side of his body. The doorbell camera showed the same man leaving the house at 1:51 p.m. The affidavit says a Minidoka County Sheriff's deputy identified the man as Naylor. At 6:21 p.m., Cassia County deputies responded to a report from a home in Burley that had two people who had been shot. Boise television station KTVB has reported Naylor's daughter said he has schizophrenia. A news release from the two counties says under a plea deal, prosecutors will not seek the death penalty and he will be sentenced to four fixed life sentences. Cassia County prosecuting attorney McCord Larson said, "This plea agreement represents justice for the victims and their families. While no outcome can undo the devastating loss these families have endured, this resolution ensures that Benjamin Roy Naylor will never walk free again." The victims' families showed tremendous courage throughout this process, and their input was critical in reaching this agreement. By securing consecutive life sentences without parole, we have achieved certainty and finality while sparing the families from years of trial proceedings and appeals. I want to thank the law enforcement officers and investigators from both counties whose tireless work on this case made this outcome possible. Our office remains committed to supporting the victims' families as they continue to heal from these unimaginable losses. Minidoka County prosecuting attorney Lance Stevenson said, "This resolution brings a measure of closure to an unspeakable tragedy that has impacted our community deeply." Contractors recently completed a 29-acre fuel reduction project in the wooded areas of Virgil Phillips Farm Park, north of Moscow, along U.S. Highway 95. Conservation the Idaho Way, the newsletter of the Idaho Soil and Water Conservation Commission, reports the project in the 160-acre park came after Latah County completed its updated community wildfire protection plan in 2023, which identified high-risk areas for wildfire. The plan said, "Recent relatively large fire events clearly illustrate the mounting urban interface issue facing Latah County. Population growth rates have been greatest in the western part of the county around Moscow, Viola, and Potlatch. Agricultural land is being subdivided and people are moving to the more rural parts of the county." The park is owned by the city of Moscow but managed by the county. It includes a number of hiking trails that lead through a variety of habitats, including forested lands, open fields, and wetlands. The park includes several intermittent streams and two ponds. It's home to a variety of wildlife species such as moose, elk, deer, black bear, birds, and amphibians. The newsletter quotes Latah County Commissioner Tom Lamar saying the local conservation district got the county moving on the project, adding, "It seems like it turned out really well." University of Idaho graduate students are taking a stand against on-campus housing costs and say the financial stress is affecting their studies. The university is addressing its ongoing student housing crisis by investing $162 million in a construction project, which includes new housing and updates to campus buildings built in the late 1960s. Graduate students Katie Turner, Richie Thaxton, and Zachary Foley submitted a letter to the Argonaut earlier this month that said, "We feel it's important to bring attention to the disconnect between the university's proposed housing rates and what the university pays its graduate students." The graduate students argue the new apartments are not affordable on the stipends for teaching assistants working at the university. Graduate students and teaching assistants help teach classes, grade classwork, and work on research projects in exchange for tuition cost waivers and a monthly stipend. Depending on the student's area of study, the stipend varies. The student said a teaching assistant stipend of $16,295 for a 9-month contract is about $1,880 per month. The students argue paying for one of the new on-campus units could mean paying 74% of their stipend for rent. Foley said the idea that this is housing built for graduate students when it's so out of line with our stipends something is out of whack here. Whether it's a stipend or the housing costs, one of them needs to change in order to make this practical for graduate students. Assistant Vice President of Campus Services Eric Elordi said the university started working on updating on-campus housing for graduate law and postdoctoral students to support the university's R1 goal. We did extensive surveys, receiving feedback from almost 2,500 current students. Elordi said the higher costs are only for the new housing, and he said there are still other housing options for graduate students at lower rates. The new development will include traditional apartment-style housing with 1- and 2-bedroom units. The university says it plans to involve students in the interior design of the renovated dorms. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area on Christmas Eve, we have 50% chance of rain before 10 p.m. tonight, snow level 6,600 feet, lowering to 4,300 feet after midnight. Cloudy, gradually becoming partly cloudy, low 36. Tomorrow, Christmas Day, 60% chance of rain, mainly after 4 p.m., mostly cloudy, high 46. Thursday night, 70% chance of rain, mainly before 10 p.m., snow level 4,900 feet, lowering to 4,200 feet after midnight, mostly cloudy, low 36. Friday, 90% chance of precipitation, rain before 4 p.m., then rain and snow. Snow level 3,500 feet, high 42, little or no snow accumulation expected. On Friday night, 80% chance of precipitation in the form of snow, mainly before 4 a.m., low 28, breezy, west winds 15 to 20, gusts up to 30. New snow accumulation less than half an inch possible. And on Saturday, 40% chance of snow before 10 a.m., mostly sunny, high 33, new snow accumulation less than half an inch possible. Currently 45 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. There's an Adopt a DJ button and also a PayPal portal. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant Christmas Eve. Coming up next, Flashpoints at 7:30, Lockdown Mosh Pit. And at 8:30, music begins in earnest with Grateful Dead Through the Decades. So stay tuned for more syndicated music from Brazil at 10 p.m. in Bossa Brasil.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP, Radio Free Moscow. Loves Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. Available online at loveskombucha.com.
For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.